going to Subotica.
Yesterday, Bubby took us to the cemetery.
Like that, I think.
And he told us that the policy there is, in Belgrade, that if you have an intermarried couple, they will allow the non-Jew to be buried in the Jewish cemetery. But they won't permit a pope, or they won't permit a clergyman from another religion from officiating. That may be the policy, they have no choice, but according, you should know, according to the halacha, this is not permissible. Not only may you not bury non-Jews near Jews in the same cemetery, you may not even bury non-religious Jews next to religious Jews in the same cemetery. And we were talking the other day, that's why the Mizrahi has their own cemetery, the Aguda has their own cemetery, the Turekarta has their own cemetery. We assume that everybody does Averis, and we assume that all the people from the Turekarta have approximately the same degree of religious observance, and all the people from the Aguda have the same, approximately the same level of religious observance, and all the people from the Mizrahi have the same. So Eichhoff and Sadekates or Russia, the Halacha says that it's not only Lachatchila, it's even B'dievet. If you buried a non-observant Jew next to a religious Jew, you have to move one of the two graves, even B'dievet. If you buried a non-Jew in a Jewish cemetery, you have to move someone's grave. You can't leave it like that. I just wanted to speak a little bit about the Jewish history of Belgrade from the Halacha. When you study Gemara, the people heard that I'm going to Belgrade at the beginning of the tour. So some of the people knew right away which Gemara that I have a discussion of the city Belgrade.
Yeah.
Yes? No, it's not going to be in the Gemara. Which Gemara to the Mefarshim, which volume of the Shas will the commentaries in the back discuss the city Belgrade? So it's in the end of Erevin, the Gemara Erevin. At the end of every Gemara you have the Rif. At the end of the Rif you have the Mordechai and the Tosefta. One of the commentaries on the bottom of the page of Tosefta is called Chasdei David, Barav David Pardo. David Pardo was a prominent Talmud Chacham in the 1700s. He was a Mechutin of the Chido. He didn't live in Belgrade. For a while he was the rabbi in Belgrade, but he was the rabbi in Sarajevo. He had quite a few outstanding Talmidim of his. So he writes that on one occasion, he lived in Sarajevo, he visited in Belgrade, and on Arab Shabbos they found out that the king, Mustafa, I don't know who it is.
Mustafa. Pasha.
So the king passed away, and so for a while they didn't know who's going to be the king. And then the parliament decided to allow his brother, the king's brother, to cover the kingdom. And the din is when you make an Erev, you have to put a mechitza around the area. So we put poles and a string on top. That's what we call Atzuras HaPesach, the frame of a door. So when you have the frame of a door, it's considered as if that's mukav, as if you have a mechitza there. So that makes the whole area into one big Rishus HaYachid. But then, that's on the level of the Reis, it's a Rishus HaYachid. But then with the Rabbanon, you have a Takana Shleim HaMelech, that if two Jewish people share the same chatzer. Reuben has a house over here, Shimon has a house over here, then there's a chatzer, there's a mechitza around the area that they both use. So Shlomo HaMelech made a takana, that they're not allowed to carry into each other's house, they're not allowed to carry into the chatzer that shared in common. They have to put away a Reuben chatzer. That way, either Reuben puts a matzah in Shimon's house, or Shimon puts a matzah in Reuben's house. If you have an apartment building with 100 different tenants of the different families, or if you have a city with 5,000 different people living in the city inside the mechitza, so let's say you have 5,000 Shomer Shabbos living there, so 4,999 people have to leave a challah in the house, in one house, so the people who live in the house, they don't have to put any challah, they live there. And when the other 4,999 put a challah there, everyone has to put a pas shleima, has to be bread, you can't put any other food. The Eruv Chatzeres purposes, you have to have 4,999 challahs, shleimas, placed in one container. And if you can't all fit in one container, then you put the rest in the second container, and so on. We streamline it. So instead of having each Shem B'Shabbos family donate pura challah. So we have, somebody goes and buys two boxes of matzahs from the store, and you give it to some Jewish person. You say, pick it up at Tefach, and you kind of shoot first. On behalf of all the Shem B'Shabbos who live here now, and on behalf of all those who are going to move in before next Pesach. So the Erev belongs to everybody. And the only time you require that each person should give a challah shleima is if the people are giving on their own. But if one person bought all the matzahs, one person bought all the challahs, you have to use bread that you say hamotzia. The Svardim say mezainas on matzahs. So that's an issue, that's a shaila. How is it acceptable for the Erev? So the Gemara says that even if you use a cake is mezainas. But if you eat a ton of cake, then it becomes hamotzia. Then you have to wash them till it's a day, and you have to say amoitz, and you have to say birchas hamazon, the whole works. So matzah by the Svardim, even though a lot of the Svardim say mezainas on the matzahs, or on my wife's scholars, when we have Svardim from my class, when Svardim from the yeshiva come, to, they bring their own challahs, because they can't, my wife's challahs, they would say mezainas on. But the din is that my wife's challahs, even though the Svardim would say mezainas on it, but if they would eat enough of the challah, they would say hamoitzin. So the Gemara said that's acceptable. So this is good. This is a Rubik HaTzeris. What do you do if you have non-Jews living in the neighborhood? So you have to rent for each and every non-Jew his apartment. You have to rent his apartment. And then Allah said, you give him a dollar, you give him even pachas mishavukruta, you give him a cookie or something. You tell him, I want to rent your apartment. So for purposes of carrying on Shabbos, is considered as if the non-Jew lives is a guest in my apartment. So he does nasar on me. So this is quite a tirchem. If you have a lot of non-Jews living in the city, you're going to go to every non-Jew and go give him a cookie and give him a dollar and say, I want to rent your apartment. It'll take forever. So in Shulchan Aruch, they have a kula. Yeah, if you have the Moshel Ha'ir, if you have the king who runs the whole city, since even though the people own their private apartments where they live. But the king has the right to station troops. He can put soldiers, he has the right to declare war. He has the right to station soldiers in your apartment if he's going to declare war. So he not only has the right to represent all the non-Jews in the city and rent out the streets of the city, he has the right even to rent out the apartments of the people as well. So what happened over here was that the Jews, that not only the can you rent from the king, you can rent from the mayor of the city who is appointed by the king, or rent from the whoever is the governor who was appointed by the king. So here the old king Mustafa had appointed a governor, had appointed a mayor over the city Belgrade, and they had the Arab running for years. But then the old king passed away, and they heard that the parliament appointed the king's brother. And the king's brother is going to reappoint everybody. Fine. He says everybody who's a governor should remain in the position. But Rav David Pardo, who was visiting in Belgrade, that the Erev Shabbos, he said, we have to go rent again from the governor. The old rental that we did is not acceptable, and it was late on Friday afternoon. So he said, there isn't enough time. Just announce that this Shabbos no one should carry, and we're going to rent again in the course of the week, and rent from the governor. So he writes that he was very upset. This whole story appears in the comments of the Chasdei David by Rav David Pardo. In the back, the last page on Erevin, in the back of the Rif, after the Tosefta, the Chasdei David, is a commentary on the Tosefta. So he says that there was a Meshulach. There would always be in 1600, 1700, at Meshulachim, the Meretz Israel raising money for the Yishuv. But the Jews in Eretz Yisrael were terrible on the Yim. Yechidor was a Meshulach for years. And Marit Al-Ghazi was a Meshulach in Europe for years. They raised money. Very prominent Talmid HaChachamim. Some of them are not so prominent, but there were a lot of Meshulach raising money. So the Chasdei David points out there was a Meshulach from Tveria raising money in Belgrade, and he disagreed with him. He says it was an avla on his part. He wasn't the local rabbi. He was from Eretz Yisrael. What did he stick his 2 cents in? And the people didn't ask him the shayla. They asked me the shayla. He says they knew who I was. They didn't know who he was. So he says it was an avla that he opened his mouth. And he He said that he's wrong, and he quotes earlier Poskim, who say explicitly, when the king dies, you have to rent all over again, even though the new king took over, the new king reappoints everybody. The old rental is no longer valid. The old rental was only valid Osman, the old system was there. See, if you have a democratic government, so we assume the new government is a hemshach of the old government. When you have a kingdom, so we don't assume the old king dies, and the parliament appoints a new king, it's not a hemshach from the old one. There's no hemshach in monarchies. So that's where that's the Masechta where they talk about the city of Belgrade. Unfortunately, most of us are Ashkenazim, but Ashkenazim hardly ever study the Svarim that were written by the Svardim from centuries ago. We only know some of the Svarim that the Shach quotes. Shach died at a very young age. Shach died in the late 1600s. So he died at a very young age, and he had a fantastic memory, and he had available to him all the Svarim from the 1500s from the Svardish Gedolim. But that's it. Many of those forms we never heard of. Many of those forms we never saw in the Shach quotes. So the Ashkenazim are not familiar with any of these Gedolim. But there were Gedolim who lived in Sephardish Gedolim, who lived over here in Belgrade. Many Gedolim who lived in Belgrade. Another source where Belgrade is mentioned is not in the Gemara, but in the Tshuvas of the Chacham Tzvi. Chacham Tzvi was an Ungarische. His grandfather was the rabbi in Budapest. At that time, in the 1600s, it wasn't called Budapest. It was called Offen. It had a different name. Budapest, I think, is a combination of two different cities. So at that time, the grandfather of the Chacham Tzvi, was an Ashkenazi, and his grandfather was an Ashkenazi. So his grandfather was the author of the Shar Ephraim, not to be confused with the Shari Ephraim, which is by somebody else. Shar Ephraim was the grandfather of the Chacham Tzvi. Why is he called Chacham Tzvi? He was an Ashkenazi. But because he learned in Constantinople, in a Sephardish yeshiva, and they gave him a smicha as a teenager at a very young age, so he stuck with that title, Chacham Tzvi, and he was accepted there was a period of time that he was accepted as a rabbi by Sephardish community. So there was a period of time that the Chacham Tzvi, will have to talk about him. Talk about Sarajevo. So there was a period of time. For 3 years, he was the rabbi in Sarajevo. Sarajevo's not so far away. So on one occasion, he says he was visiting in Belgrade, just like 100 years later. David Pardo lived in Sarajevo. He was visiting in Belgrade. So in the 1600s, the late 1600s, the Chacham Tzvi was visiting in Belgrade. And in his Tshuvas, the Ashkenazim read his Tshuvas, Tshuvas Chacham Tzvi, quoted all the time, the commentaries on Shulchan Aruch quoted. So he writes, he was visiting in Belgrade, and there was a Meshulach from Eretz Yisrael, I don't think from Tveria, a different one, raising money. And the Meshulach was a Nozer Shimshon. I thought that it was something special that when I first visited Eretz Yisrael, we had money for Abdovitz Soloveitchik, so we went to his home. We looked on the mailboxes to see what apartment he lived in. So we saw that Rav David HaKayim, the Nozer, lived in the same building as Rav David Soloveitchik lives now. So we went to visit the Nozer. So the Nozer had his yarmulke up in the air like this, because he had a head full of hair that was in between his yarmulke and his head. He was a colorful individual, the Nozer. He was very Talmud of Rav Kook, very Mekuriv to Rav Kook. And those who learned in Merkaz Rav Kook at that time, they all knew about the Nozer. So I thought it was unusual that I met a Nozer. So the Chacham Tzvi writes, he visited in Belgrade, and there was a Nozer Shimshon. Nozer Shimshon is not allowed to drink wine, but he's been committed to be Metamei Lameisim. So he was a Nozer Shimshon on the side, in addition to being Meshulah for raising money for Eretz Yisrael. And they once had a Suda. So the Mechabed, this Nozer, he should bench Halayayin. But the Nozer is not allowed to drink wine. Nozer Shimshon not allowed to drink wine either. He's permitted to be Metamei Lameisim, not allowed to drink wine. So he didn't want to hold the cup. You tell the Nozer, don't go through, the Gemara has the expression, tell the Nozer, don't walk through the vineyard. You may by mistake pull off some of the grapes. Tell the Nozer, walk around the vineyard. Don't walk through the vineyard. So they wanted the Mechabit, the Nozer, he should bench Mezumen. Alakos, so someone else held the kos. He said the benching out loud. the end of the benching. So the other person who was holding the kos, you have to hold up the kos at tefach above the table, above the ground, wherever it is. So the other fellow who was holding the kos yayin said, and then he drank it. So the Chacham Tzvi said, I gave them over the head. What kind of ridiculous thing is that? Whenever you say a bracha ala kos, we say kiddush ala kos, we say abdol ala kos. When you get married, you say birchas erison ala kos, birchas yisuin sheva brachas ala kos. And when you say birchas hamazon ala kos, the one who's saying the bracha has to hold the kos. You don't have one person hold the kos and the other person say the bench. You want someone else to hold the kos, be mechaber the other person, he should hold the kos. It's not right, you shouldn't hold the kos. In fact, in Shulchan Aruch, there's a whole discussion. When you say Havdalah, so we say Bar Pi Aglofen, then we're going to say Havdalah. So between Bar Pi Aglofen and Havdalah, we say Bar Min Sum and Bar Mi Ariyoesh. So a lot of people have the practice, they put down the cup of wine and they pick up the psalmic box. Put down the psalmic box and they pick up the Havdalah candle. And then they put that down and then they say the Havdalah Alakos. So that's not right. If he's saying the Bar Min Psalmim and the Bar Mi Ariyoesh in the middle of the Havdalah, he said it's all supposed to be halakos. He's supposed to be holding the cup of wine while you say barim miarheish and barim minim something. That's supposed to put it down. And even more than that, in the Shulchan Aruch it says that you switch hands. It says when you first start havdalah, you hold the cup of wine in your right hand. Then when you want to say barim minim b'samim, so you put the cup of havdalah wine in your left hand and you hold the b'samim in the right hand. Because the Gemara says you should always hold in the right hand the thing that you're going to say the bracha over. So the quote from the Vilna Gaon, it's not in Shulchan Aruch, the quote from the Vilna Gaon on the Gemara and Brachas in the commentary that's called Imre Noah, the Talmidic quote from the Gra, that that's not right. What correct is, you should hold the cup of Abdullah in your hand, in your right hand, if a person is a righty. Hold the cup of Abdullah in his right hand the whole time. And you should say the Barim Minim Samim, hold the Samim in the left hand. Not only should he not put down the cup of wine, shouldn't even switch hands. So these are the two places where Belgrade was quoted. Once in the very last page in Erev, and at the very end, the end, after the Rif, and after the Tosefta. So the Chasdei David has commentaries on the bottom of the page of Tosefta. And after the Tosefta, it's all over. They have this long comment about the story of what happened when he visited Belgrade. That was in the late 1700s. Because the Chasdei David was a mechutzen from the with the chidah, and then in the Tshuvas of the Chacham Tzvi, which Ashkenazim do you, his name was Rav Tzvi Hirsch Ashkenazi. He was an Ashkenazi. He was not a Sephardi. He maintained the name Chacham because he got smicha from the Sephardi in Constantinople. So the Chacham Tzvi mentions this incident that happened that when he was visiting in Belgrade. The Nazir Shimshon, the whole story is so surprising. The Nazir Shimshon benched Alakos and someone else were holding it, and he explained to them that it's dead wrong, and they finally agreed with him. He convinced them and they finally agreed. But there were Gedolim in Belgrade in the 1600s, 1700s. One of the outstanding Gedolim wrote quite a few Svarim, fantastic Svarim. But apparently there was a big Srefa, there was a big fire in the city of Belgrade. Apparently on more than one occasion, there was a big fire. And all of his manuscripts, everything was destroyed. And one of this Gadol, his name was Rabbi Yehuda Lirma. Rabbi Yehuda Lirma. And he wrote over 400 tshuvas. He wrote several svarim on different masichtas and all halacha topics. Everything was destroyed. So this Rabbi Yehuda Lirma, who died in the middle of the 1600s, he had a Talmud, Reb Simcha HaKoyen, who felt so terrible, and he trained this Talmud in learning, and it would appear that there were a lot of Talmidim. There wasn't only one. It seems that he had a big yeshiva, and it couldn't be that he just founded the yeshiva. If you found the yeshiva, you get one Talmud. He's not going to be so outstanding at learning. These people wrote tshuvas; they quote everything. It's a different kind of a tshuva. If you write a tshuva, now. 1900s and the 2000s, so you're right, this Pesach says this and this Pesach says that. That's one style of writing. He didn't have all these svarim. He didn't have anything. So this Rabbi Yehuda Lirma, in his tshuvas, who does he quote? He didn't have the Shach. He was before the Shach was printed. He doesn't quote Shalsa. He quotes Rav Yosef Karo and the Beis Yosef. He quotes a lot. He quotes Marival, Maria Ben Lev, who was from Salonika in the 1500s. He quotes different posts. He doesn't quote this from that we would quote. He didn't have them. He quotes from the Tosfos Yontif, who's still alive. Tosfos Yontif was alive in the 1600s, like the Shach in Yerideya, every so often. Quotes something from the Tosfos Yontif. Tosfos Yontif wrote the commentaries on the bottom of the Rosh. That's called Madani Yontif. So in the days of the Shach, the name of the Sefer was Madani Melech. And then Yontif Litman Hela got into trouble. They said he's murdered the Malchus. He declares himself as the king. So they put him in prison for a while, and then he said it didn't mean anything. So they changed the name of the Sefer to Madani Yontif. That was his name, of Yontif Litman Heller. So the Shach quotes it as Madani Melech, Femayin Mem. When the Shach used the Sefer, the name was not yet changed. So every so often, the Shach disagrees with the Tosfos Yontif. So then he'll have a parenthesis, the Heshiv. The Heshiv means the Tosfos Yontif corresponded with him. And he answered it. So the Shach is corresponding with the Tosfos. He was alive at the same time. So this Rav Yehuda Lirma was a contemporary of the Tosfos Yontif. So I just found it interesting. He's not quoting any of the poskim that we would quote. He doesn't have any Shachs. He doesn't have a Pistei Tshuva. He lived in the 1600s. So he quotes Rav Yosef Karo and the Marival and the Trumas Hadesh and earlier poskim. He doesn't quote them. He didn't have access. He lived in the 1600s. So I thought it was very interesting. You find the Tshuvas, all of his Svarim were burnt. And this Talmud of his, whom he trained in Psak, and he encouraged the Talmud to write Tshuvas while the Rebbe was still alive. He said, I want to train you. You write a Tshuva and I'll review it. So this Talmud Rabbi Nesimcha felt terrible. Why all of the hundreds of Tshuvas of his Rebbe were all destroyed by the fire. Right from the Hakdamah to the Sefer. He calls the Sefer Pleitas Beis Yehuda. This is what the remnants, what's left over from my Rebbe of Yehuda, Lirma. Everything was destroyed by the fire. So how did he get these Tshuvas? So he asked some of the Balabatim in the village to whom the Rebbe had written Tshuvas. He asked them to give him the Tshuvas so he could print them. So he only had 27 Tshuvas of the Rebbe. And he put in 3 of his own Tshuvas into the Sefer, that it should add up to 30. 2 of the 3 Tshuvas, he writes, these the Rebbe encouraged me to write the Tshuva. And then he has what the Rebbe, Rav Yehuda Lirma, commented after he read his Tshuva. He says, Gevaldik, you're right, you're paskin correctly, he agrees with it. It's interesting, the Tshuvas, most of the Tshuvas that they wrote at that time, and years later, they were all on Dini Mominus. Sichsuchim between 2 Jews. Today, you hardly have Tshuvas written on Dini Mominus like this. People go to secular court, or they get lawyers, and they make some kind of a pshara, whatever. At that time, they were religious Jews. You're not allowed to go to our courts. You're not allowed to go to secular court. So he has most of Ruba, the Ruba of the Tshuvas, were all on Dini Mominus. I found it interesting. This Rav Yehuda Lirma, he always signs his name instead of Yehuda with a hey, he signs with an aleph, Yehuda. I guess that's the way they pronounced it. I don't know, but I found it interesting. One of the shaylas, I wasn't interested in reading the Tshuvas on Dini Mominus because they all get involved in what the facts of the case are. So I read one of the Tshuvas. I didn't have access to this. I was in Eretz Israel the last 3 weeks. So I didn't have available to me this Sefer. It's a rare Sefer, Leitas Beis Yehuda, the Tshuvas that were left over. So I borrowed it from the Merkaz Harav Yeshiva. They were kind enough to lend it to me. And I read through some of the Tshuvas. He has an interesting Tshuva. A person took a net, a Shvua, he will not sleep overnight in someone's home. So instead of saying, I take the Shvua, so he said, I accept upon myself the Nazir Shimshon that I will not sleep over in your home. What kind of a cockeyed way of speaking is that? So he has a whole tshuva. Does that have the status of a shvuah? So the Rishonim discuss, what if you said the wrong word? And then there is an isa and a cheftza. The shvuah is a din on the gavra. So let's say a person says, I take a neder, I will not walk to shul today. You can't take a neder, I'll not walk to shul. You have to take a neder, the potato chips are also vachil on it. Or you take a shvuah, I will not walk to shul. You can't take a shvuah, the potato should be awesome. The shvuah has to be on the person, and the neder has to be on the chevtza. So usually people say, I take a neder, I will not go to shul today. So that's really a shvuah b'losh a neder. He says, I take a neder. Here he took a shvuah, I will not sleep here tonight. A shvuah b'losh a nezira shimshin. What kind of a cockeyed loshin is that? As apparently that's the way people spoke at that time. Whoever thinks of a nezira shimshin today. He has a whole shul about this. What's the din?
Excuse me.
But the shul that I was surprised about was he has a shul about ribis. So this Rabbi Yehuda Lerma, who lived in the 1600s, says he's surprised. I didn't understand fully what he was talking about, but the Rosh Hashanah of ribis, because he throws in a goyish word in the middle of the shul, a word from Serbian or from Yugoslavian language. So I don't know what it corresponds to. So he complains about a certain practice that the businessmen had in Belgrade in the 1500s about lending to each other. They had some practice, and he says he thinks that it's prohibited because of ribis, and he surprised our city that so many Talmid HaChachamim for so many years, how can they have allowed this all along? He's talking about a very religious... People who don't know violate ribbis all the time. Every month they can understand they violate ribbis. He's talking about a community where the people are very observant, and so many Talmid HaChachamim, this was in the 1600s, he writes like that. So this, Rabbi Yehuda Lerma passed away, and his Talmid, Rabbi Simcha HaKayin, he had a last name also, I forgot already. So this Rabbi Simcha HaKayin was appointed as the rabbi after him. This Rabbi Simcha HaKayin, 10 years after he printed the Sefer from his Rebbe, the Plato's Beis Yehuda, the tshuvas that were left over, that survived, like the Sri Deyesh, the tshuvas that survived the war, the Second World War, of Yechiel Weinberg. So this is the Plato's Beis Yehuda, were the tshuvas that weren't eaten up by the fire. So 10 years after he printed that Sefer from his Rebbe, he printed his own Sefer on Seamus Gittin. Seamus Gittin, it's easy if a person name is Moshe, or Shlomo, Aharon, or Tzvi. So you're right, the way the name appears in Tanakh, easy enough. But they had Spanish names and Portuguese names. They had a lot of Spartan in Belgrade. So you have to know, how do you transliterate? How do you carry over a Spartish name into Hebrew? So that's what all the Svarim of Shem is getting on. Woman's name is Spritzer, whatever. So there's no official way to spell it. So all the Svarim of Shem is getting on. How do you carry over a French name or an English name or something like that? Really, it could be an easy solution. Write the whole get in Hebrew. And write the name in Serbian. Write the name in a different alphabet in Shem. So we don't do that. The Choshish for the Rambam's opinion. The Rambam in Hilchos Geirushin quotes a Tosefta that says that if you write a get in two different languages, part of the get is written in Hebrew and part of the get is written in English, so the whole get is no good. There's no hemshah. There's no continuation from one language to the other. The Ravid says that this is an incorrect reading in the Tosefta, and the din is not so. But that was the girsa that the Rambam had. So we are machmer for that Rambam. Gittin is a real serious din deraisa. When you daven, so that was always a practice that people were daven in Hebrew, the text of the davening in Hebrew. And the Chafetz Chaim and other tzaddikim, the Siddish Rebbe, they would add on Tfinis and Yiddish in the middle of the Shemoneh Esrei. We assume there is a hemshach between Hebrew and Yiddish, one language and the other. But the davening is only with the Rabban. But a get is a real din deraisa, so we machmer for the Shittas HaRambam that there's no continuation, there's no hemshachius between one language and another, one script and another script. So you have to figure out how do you transliterate the names into Ksav Ashuris. So this Rav Shlomo HaKayin had access to quite a few Svarim. Some were written by Ashkenazim, some were written by Svartim. How did he have access to the Svarim written by Ashkenazim? He was a Svarti. The answer is, his parents were a mixed marriage. His mother was from Budapest, and his father was a Sephardi. So he had, because his mother was in Budapest and he used to visit his mother's family very often, they're not sure exactly why. They think the father probably died when he was young, and the mother probably moved back to Budapest. He probably went to visit his mother. So because he was every month in Gdansk, he was visiting Budapest, so he had access to Ashkenazi Sorm as well on Shemus Gittin. So he put out a sefer that was that quoted what everybody had to say, both the Ashkenazim and the Sfardim. There was an incident that was a big cause celebre that caused a big machlokes. This of Shlomo HaKoyen, the one who took over the Rabbanus in Belgrade when his Rebbe, Rabbi Yehuda Lirma, passed away. So he became famous after, even before he wrote the sefer Shemus Gittin, he was famous. And then he gained in fame because everybody was using the sefer. When you masada again, that's the only shaila that you usually have is how to spell the names, that are goyish names. How do you transliterate the names? Now that takes time to be koveya, the spelling of a name. So he became more famous. So he was appointed the rabbi in Budapest, which at that time is not known as Budapest, but it's called Offa. So he stayed there for 2 months, and he resigned and he went back to Belgrade. Why did he resign? Because 5 years earlier, this was in 1660, so 5 years earlier, 1655, a big Talmid Chacham from Vilna was passing through Budapest on his way to move to Yerushalayim, Eretz Yisrael. And the Balabatim in the city said to this prominent Talmid Chacham from Vilna, does he have any good ideas for takanas for their kehillah? What would be a nice takana? So he wrote them a few takanas. So one of the takanas was the following, that they should never appoint a rabbi in the city who has relatives in the city, because it will just bring machlekes. It always used to be machlekes, when you would appoint a rabbi in the community, it would always cause machlekes. It would start him for the rabbi and start him against the rabbi. So he said, you should never appoint a rabbi who has relatives in town. If he has relatives, then it's going to be terrible. There are rabbis in America whom the Balabatim want to retire. So they get 20 of their relatives to become members of the shul. Then they show up at the election. Then they say, we just became members and we're entitled to a vote. And they vote their relative in again for another 5 years. And then at the end of the 5 years, he gets another couple of relatives to become members of the shul. So that's what this Rav Feivish from Vilna said, that he made a takana. So he wrote down this takana. So 5 years later, 1660, that's when they appointed Rav Shlomo HaKoyen as he should come from Belgrade to become the Rav in Budapest. So he came there, and then he brought up the issue. So after 2 months he left and he went back to Belgrade. So the Shaila was 10 years later an issue came up in a different community, whether that Takana should be followed. So the Shaila was, why did he go in the first place? He knew there was such a takana, and why did he go in the first place? So some say he wasn't aware of the takana. Others think that that's ridiculous. How can he not be aware? Well, the rabbin in Belgrade signed on to the takana. So he was the rabbi in Belgrade. He was the main rabbi in Belgrade when that takana was made 5 years earlier. So of course he knew about the takana. So the Shar Ephraim, who was the rabbi, the prominent rabbi in Budapest, that was the grandfather of the Chacham Tzvi. So the Shar Ephraim wrote a whole tshuva. Why did Rav Shlomo originally agree? What was the Havamina? How can he come if it's against the Takana? So he gives two suggestions, both interesting. One suggestion he gives is the Takana wasn't misparsed. When you make a Takana, you have to have the whole Kehillah should agree to it. This Takana was never publicized. This Rav Feivish, who was there 5 years earlier, 1655, wrote on a piece of paper Takana. And three or four Rabbanim held the piece of paper, but the whole community never really agreed upon it. So then, when they appointed Rav Shlomo, he knew about it, but since it was never the sparsim, so he thought it was never the skabel. So he thought that it wouldn't apply here, but then when it started, all machlekes, so then he said he doesn't want machlekes, and he went back to Belgrade. But then the Shar Ephraim has another suggestion, which is really the ikar. He says, how many people voted when they had the election for this rabbi? He says there were 89, the facts are, 89 people were voting. I don't know exactly why did they decide they only had 89 people in the committee. I don't know. 89 people voted. 80 people voted for him. And 9 voted against. And he didn't have, the 80 people were not all his relatives. Even if you would subtract all from the 80 people, all of his relatives, he still would win by a landslide. He still won. maybe five of them were his uncles, whatever. But the other 75. So that's the pashtus, that this takana that Rav Feivish made, that a rabbi shouldn't be appointed in a city where he has relatives. Thus, if his relatives were the ones who are machriya, they're the ones who made him the rabbi because there was a split vote and the relatives voted him in, that's not right. It's certainly not right the way we have in America. The rabbi gets all of his cousins who live in Arba Kampus Haaretz to become members of the shul, and then they only show up. They never show up at all. They don't live in the city. They only come up when it's time for the election. So that's for sure. That's not right. That's against the takana. But over here, this Rav Shlomo would have won even without that. Whatever it was, that was the Maisa Shahoy. So this Rav Shlomo had a son-in-law who was a big Talmud Chacham. His name is Rav Yosef Almosi Nino. A Sfardish Goyim. And he wrote Shadis Tshuvas called Eidus Behiyo Seif. He is interesting. His Tshuvas are very nice. Tshuvas are very nice. Also, when I was in Merkos Arab, they wouldn't lend me they didn't have a copy of it, Eidus Behiyo Seif. So they wouldn't lend it to me, but on their Otzar HaChachma that they had access to, so they were kind enough to print out two tshuvas. I told them which two, so I read two of the tshuvas. Also, Ruba the Ruba of the tshuvas are all about Dini Mamanis. These were Frume Balabatim who wouldn't go to secular court. They went to a Din Torah. So he has boring tshuvas about the details of the case, what the psak was. Fine. And also, it was in the early 1700s. So what are they going to quote? He also doesn't have access to a shach. He doesn't have anything that shach and a taz and a pistach. We write shuvas. We can quote all the svarim. They didn't have access to all this. So he quotes Yosef. Always quoting Yosef. Yeah. So it's interesting. It's interesting. One of the two shuvas that I read is that Shemus Gittin. So he quotes from his father-in-law Sefer, this Rav Shlomo HaKohen, his father-in-law, who went to Budapest and they went back to Belgrade. So this Rav Yosef Almosi Nino, he took over the father-in-law's rabbonis in Belgrade after the father-in-law passed away. The last years of the father-in-law, he was old and weak, and he helped them in functioning as a rabbi, and then he took over, they appointed him as the rabbi after. So he quotes what his father-in-law wrote about the spelling of a certain name. And he writes, but you got to keep in mind, you have to know, the girl's name was, I forgot already, some kind of a Spanish name. So he said, but she wasn't from Spain, she was from Portugal. And they pronounce it like this. And in Spain they pronounce it like that. So my father-in-law wrote in the sefer, that's for Sephardim. This girl was from Portugal, so they pronounce it differently. Then he has interesting, the din is, let's say a person when he's born, he was given one name. I was born, by the Brits, they gave me the name Tzvi. Then later on when I was a little boy, so they didn't call me Tzvi, they called me Herschel. So that's my nickname. So when I get an aliyah, there's a name, Shem Arisa and Shulchan Aruch, there are three names that you have to consider when you write a get. Shem Arisa, the name that the baby had when he was in the crib. Shem Arisa in the cradle. Then you have Shem Sha'ola Bala Torah, the name that he uses when he gets an aliyah, and Shem Shenikra Befi HaKol. My father, Zechanu Lech, used to be a Masada Gittin. So he had liked to tell the story that he once asked a girl who was getting divorced. So he asked the girl, when your father gets an aliyah, and he makes a Mishaberach for you, what name does he use? And the girl said, what do you mean my father gets an aliyah? When I get an aliyah, this is the way they call me. So in the Shulchan Aruch, they talk about the three names, the Shem Arisa, Shem Sha'ola Bala Torah, so let's say the person had a name, Hashem Arisa. Nobody calls him with that name. Nobody. Nobody calls him with that name. That's Hashem Shenishtaka. That name is forgotten. If you forget about it, you call him a new name. Unless the new name is just a corruption of the old name. Let's say his name was Shlomo. And they call him Kemat the same. Shlomo. They call him Shlomo. Nobody calls him Shlomo. Everybody calls him Shlomo. So that's... Yeah, but it's basically the old name. So you write Shlomo. So he says, when someone is born and they give him a name, the name is after a Baba. So you have to find out, was the Baba from Spain or from Portugal? What was the original name? Even though we're calling the name by a corrupt pronunciation, But this baby is named after a baba, a girl. This Maisa Shai was about a girl, so the girl was named after her grandmother, her great aunt, or whatever. So what was the original pronunciation of the name? That's how you have to write it. So he has a whole detailed tshuva. He says that what his father-in-law wrote in his sefer on the Shemus Gittin doesn't apply here, because the father-in-law wrote it for Spanish people, Spanish-speaking people, and this woman was from Portugal, not from Spain. Then he has another fascinating tshuva, also about Vini Mominis, a whole complicated story. Shaila, if I damaged someone else, I'm Odama Mazik, I have to pay. If I damage indirectly, so that's a thing, grab him in Ezek and his punch. And if Hezek was partially a little in between direct Hezek and indirect, that's called Garmi, Grame. So Garmi, we paskan like Rav Meir, it's a machloek, we paskan Rav Meir doin dina de Garmi. Rav Meir used to say you have to pay. So he has to go into the details. Sometimes if I cause the person a hefsid, he had to hire a lawyer in order to defend himself because of a whole false claim that I made, so I'm chayiv to pay him the legal fees. That's in Shulchan Aruch. A lot of times a person has false claims against me, I have to defend myself. So later on the Bezin paskens all of his claims are false, so he has to pay me for all the legal fees. That's Medina de Garmi. There's a long tshuva about Medina de Garmi, and he goes through the rules and the regulations. But the way he goes through it, he only has he lived in the early 1700s, so he quotes Beis Yosef. Beis Yosef quotes a Rashba. Today nobody would quote a Beis Yosef. You would quote the later poskim. He quoted Shachar Chashmish. He quoted Pischei Tshuva. He wouldn't quote a Beis Yosef. He has from the early generations. These were some of the Gdolim, and then there were more. But they had in Belgrade, they had in the 1600s, 1700s, they had Gedolim Mamish, Sfardish Gedolim, who were very big in learning. It was only after the Reform movement in Germany and Hungary, then everything became a kulkal over here in this part of the world. You mentioned earlier, we were talking about these three rabbanim, about Rabbi Yehuda Lirma, who was a big Talmud Chacham, wrote Tshuvas in the middle of 1600s, and his Talmud, Rav Simcha HaKoyim, and his son-in-law, Rav Yosef Al-Mosi Nino. So I mentioned that this Rav Yosef Al-Mosi Nino was involved in the Shaita in the early 1700s in a big machlokes with the Chacham Tzvi. That by Ashkenazim, we heard of the Chacham Tzvi, we hardly ever heard of this Al-Mosi Nino. He was Asfardi, so the Chacham Tzvi was an Ashkenazi, so we study his story. But Yosef Al-Mosi Nino was also a big Talmud Chacham. So the Chacham Tzvi got involved in a big machlokes. He was a rav in different communities. Each place it was only for 3 years. He always said his opinion. He wasn't politically correct. He wasn't nicely put into the wealthy balabatim, and he always rubbed them the wrong way. You don't have to go out of your way to fight with the wealthy balabatim. So he never lasted too long in any community. So he was 3 years. He was a rabbi in Amsterdam for the Ashkenazi community. So at that time, there was a big hullabaloo. Sephardi, by the name of Nehemia Chayun, I think, came to Amsterdam, and he wanted to sell a sefer on Kabbalah.
Oh, I missed the train, it's well bad.
And the sefer on Kabbalah was apparently written by a follower of Shabbosai Tzvi. So the Shabbosai Tzvi story was over already. Shabbosai Tzvi is no longer alive. Shabbosai Tzvi was a Meshuggah who had hallucinations that he was the Melech HaMashiach. So because at the end of the story he got a lot of people to follow him. Everything was based on Kabbalah. Everything was Kabbalah. And the people had suffered so much from pogroms for so many centuries. They were chalashing for Moshiach to come. So this Meshuggah came and he said he was Moshiach. So many Tamir Chachamim believed him. So this Al-Mosi Nino, who married the daughter of Rav Simcha HaKohen became the rabbi in Belgrade after his father-in-law passed away. When he was younger, he had learned in Eretz Yisrael. He was born in Europe, and he learned in Eretz Yisrael. In Eretz Yisrael, he became friendly with some of the followers of Shabtai Tzvi. He probably didn't think Shabtai Tzvi was the Mashiach, but he went along with their version of Kabbalah. So their version of Kabbalah had some kind of shtick about the Trinity. That the Shekhinah is one entity, and if it's like they say, there are seven spheres. So there are those who are not happy about saying there are seven spheres. If God has seven parts, if there are seven gods, well, what does it mean? The Shekhinah has seven parts. It doesn't make sense. So so this book, this fellow, this Nehemiah Chiyun, came to Amsterdam to sell his book on Kabbalah. So the Chacham Tzvi looked at the book and he said it's based on Shabtai Tzvi and it's apikursis and you have to burn the book. So there was a big machlokes at that time. So what happened was, because Chacham Tzvi in Amsterdam was the rabbi of the Ashkenazi community and he didn't consult, the one who was selling the book was a Sephardi, and he didn't consult the local Sephardi rabbi. So the local Sephardi rabbi and the board of directors of his community assumed that this is an Ashkenazi shtick, and the Sephardim don't agree with him. So they approved of the book. They made, the end of the story was, they made a big Kabbalah part of this Nehemiah Chiyun. And they said, Chacham Tzvi had no right to put his book in Cherev and to burn the book. The end of the story was they chased the Chacham Tzvi out of town. And even his own Balabatim chased him out of town. They stopped paying him his salary. The end of the story that it was that he had to leave. One of the Sephardi and several of the Sephardi rabbis in other communities also supported this Nehemiah Chiyun. So this Rabbi Yosef Arnosi Nino, who was the rabbi in Belgrade, heard about the Machlokes. Everybody in Europe heard about the Machlokes. He also supported Nehemiah Chiyun against the Chacham Tzvi. By us, it sounds like a joke that Chacham Tzvi everybody heard of. And this Arnosi Nino, we never heard of. But he was a big Talmid Chacham. His tshuva is abnormal. Somehow they didn't see that there was a problem about this idea of the Trinity. And more in recent years, there was the Sava Kadisha, as he was known, a big Spartish in the Kubel, who moved, he lived to well over 100, and he moved to Eretz Yisrael at the end of his life. He was also going to put out a sefer, he put out many Svarim, Halacha and Kabbalah. He was also going to put out a sefer on Kabbalah, and he had one chapter in the sefer also about the Trinity, that we believe in the Trinity, three different aspects of Elokus. And he gave a copy of the sefer to Rav Kook, the first chief rabbi, right? So he gave a copy to Rav Kook to look at before he prints it. The Rav Kook asked his Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Yaakov Moshe Chalap, to go quickly to the Sava Kadisha, tell him to leave out that chapter about the Trinity, that's going to be misinterpreted and misunderstood. We don't believe in the Trinity. So it's interesting, this Chacham Tzvi made such a ruckus, he made such a machlokes. Chacham Tzvi was born after the whole Shabtai Tzvi story was all over. He was born in 1660 or something like that. But he made such a fuss when this Nehemiah Chiyun came to Amsterdam, so this left an indelible impression on his son, Rabbi Yaakov Emden, who was a young boy. He lived through all of this. So years later, he always saw Shabtai Tzvi. He was always concerned. He always very sensitive to them. So that's why years later he accused Rabbi Anderson Abishitz of being a follower of Shabtai Tzvi, which was a little ridiculous. Rabbi Anderson Abishitz was not a follower of Shabtai Tzvi. Rabbi Anderson Abishitz was the Gadol HaDor in that generation. People knew Rabbi Anderson Abishitz was in Hamburg, and it was against the law to have a copy of the Gemara. Rabbi Anderson Abishitz used to give shiurim on Gemara, Rashi, and Tosfos, and make the Yukim. How come the Lashon is like this? The Yukim and Rashi, the Yukim and Tosfos. And students came from all over Europe to hear his shiurim. They knew that when they get there to Hamburg, they won't be able to have a Gemara. All the shiurim are going to be Baal Peh, and all the shiurim are going to be at the Yukim. He didn't give a lecture-style shiur. He gave the Yukim. And nonetheless, they came to hear the shiurim of Rabbi Yonasan Emden. He was the Gadol HaDor. Yaakov Emden had a printing press. He was a Talmid Chacham. He had a printing press. I kept up printing svarim, attacking one after the other after the other, attacking the Rebbe Rav Yenis and Eibishitz. That was a scandalous period in Jewish history. Louis Ginsberg, who used to be at the Jewish Theological Seminary, published a book, Students, Saints, and Scholars. Brief biographies about different Jewish leaders, Jewish rabbis in different generations, very interesting. So he writes about this dispute between, it was a terrible machlokes, Rabbi Yaakov Emden, Rabbi Yonis and Eibishitz. So he writes that in German there's an expression that the most beautiful flowers grow in mud, in filthy mud. So he said, let's just look at the flowers. We read Rabbi Yonis and Eibishitz Svarim, and we read Rabbi Yaakov Emden Svarim, and we take whatever is acceptable, we'll accept it. Beautiful flowers will help you. You don't have to analyze the mud. You have to get involved in the machlokes. This Amos Inino, he disagreed with the Chacham Tzvi. And he didn't see what was wrong with this book of Nechemiah Chiyud. Nechemiah didn't write it. He was selling it. He didn't see that there was anything wrong with believing in this form of the Trinity. The village that we're going to visit now, Novi Sad.
Yes.
The Jews used to call it Neizatz. I guess at different times it was in different hands, in different governments. So there was a period of time that it was part of Hungary. And it's known that the Chasam Sofer had two Talmidim, the Rabbanim there, one after the other. So there's an official biography book, small thin book, about the three generations of Talmid Chachamim, about Rabbi Akiva Eger, the father-in-law of the Chasam Sofer, and then the Chasam Sofer himself, and then one of the Chasam Sofer's sons, the Ksav Sofer, the son that took over the Rabbanus in Pressburg. He had more than one son, but this book was written by a son of the Ksav Sofer. He writes about, the name of the book is Chutam Shulosh. Chutam Shulosh Lodim Heri Yenote. So he calls the name of the book and the biographies Chutam Shulosh. He writes that when the Chasam Sofer was in Matasdar, before he got the Rabbanus in Pressburg, so he had a yeshiva, had people from all over came to learn at his yeshiva. And he had people who were on a certain level of learning. He had all the teenagers who were learning. They had been learning for years before their bar mitzvah they were learning. So he writes, that once a 17-year-old boy came who had never opened the Gemara before in his life. He was observant, he was religious, but he never learned anything. He came to the Chasam Sofer, his yeshiva, and he wanted to listen to the shiur. So the Talmidim were all laughing at him. He won't understand one word. You're not familiar with Gemara. You don't know how to learn. So Chasam Sofer was upset. He told the Talmidim, you're not allowed to laugh at him. He's so sincere. He wants to learn. So he made a whole schedule. He made every student in yeshiva commit himself to learn with this young man for an hour. So Sunday morning, 9 to 10, one student learned with him. Then 10:30 to 11:30, another student learned. Then every hour and a half or so, another student learned all week long. Each student had to commit himself to learn for an hour a week with this fellow. And the fellow had a shvachet cup. Whenever they would teach him something, he would forget it right away. He wouldn't understand it. They had to explain it 100 times until he understood. But then he picked up, and he became a regular big Talmid Chacham. His name was Rav Pinchas Leib. I'm not embarrassed to write his name. The name is Rav Pinchas Leib. And they write, he became the rabbi in Neizatz, in this village. And at that time, it could be that it was part of Hungary. I think at that time it was part of Hungary. And he corresponded with the Chasam Sofer on different issues, mostly in Ebenezer, issues. Very interesting, serious shaylos. So the Chasam Sofer writes to him with big respect. He refers to him as, he doesn't call him his Talmud, he calls him his dear friend, Yedidi. And then another tshuvah, he'll refer to a svara that this Pinchas Leib said to him. He approves of the svara, he brought him a rifle in the Gemara. This Rav Pinchas Leib passed away. So after he passed away, another Talmud of the Chasam Sofer took over the Rabbanus there. He was already weaker. His name was Rabotchai, I forgot the last name. And he wrote a few svarim. I looked at one of the svarim, it's all drushes that he gave. I wanted to say over something interesting from him, but I didn't, nothing appealed to me. The small sefer that I took out from the library had around 30 drushes in it. He writes in the introduction, he's happy that with the publication of this sefer, he now published 100 of his drushes. These 30, together with another two svarim that he put out before, added up to 100 drushes, and he's all excited. I wasn't so taken by the drushes. I think that sefer was called Agados Mordechai. His name was Mordechai, and he's giving drushes on Agadatis and the Gemara. So he was already a weaker in learning, but the sefer has tshuvas to him also. So one of the tshuvas, he relates to the previous rabbi, that's Rav Pinchas Leib. This Rav Pinchas Leib had an asik with a certain family, and he had them write on the Pinchas HaKehillah that this certain person, he and his mother are liars, and if they ever get involved in a din Torah, you cannot trust them with a shvuah. They're prepared to swear falsely. So there was a different rabbi in this community, this Naizat, who started investigating, opening up the whole story, is it really so? Are they not Nehmanim? And then this student of the Chassam Sofer, who was a dayan in Naizatz, after the first one, after the Chassam Sofer passed away, he corresponded with the Chassam Sofer, and the Abba Psak from the Besdin, does it make sense that you question whether they made a mistake or not? So the Chassam Sofer writes in back, you're not supposed to question. He quotes the Gemara, the Besdin gave a psak, you assume that it's correct. If you have kashas against it, so then the Gemara says, if you personally think that there's a wrong, then you have to start investigating. But nobody thought there was anything fishy. So why did the other rabbi in the village, why did he start investigating? But apparently it was a religious village where they needed a Hungarian rabbi. And this sefer of drushes, by the second student of the Chassam Sofer, a Mordechai, that's called Agadas Mordechai, the one that I saw, so that said that he was in the Haskamas, they write, there was a rabbi in Naizatz in Hungary, apparently at that time was part of Hungary.
Because he's telling the people to violate the halacha. The halacha says
when you give tzedakah, even if you're donating to the Beis HaMikdash, you always have to leave over something for yourself. You're not allowed to give away all of your assets to tzedakah or to the Beis HaMikdash. And this crackpot, this man who claimed to be the Mashiach, was encouraging the Jews in Tehran to give away all of their money to tzedakah. So the Rambam says that he has a famous Igeres Tehran, where he tells you, this man is not Mashiach. He quotes all the psukim about Bias HaMashiach. He says he can't be the Mashiach. He's telling the people to violate the halacha. As we know now, Mashiach is not going to change any halacha. He's not going to violate the halacha. We believe that the Mashiach is going to be a human being. There was one opinion in the days of the Gemara that there'll be a period of Mashiachiyut. There are a period of peace, but there won't be a melech HaMashiach, a human being, a bas of a done human being. So that opinion was rejected. The one who held like that, his name was Rabbi Hillel, not the famous Hillel. He lived 100 years before the Churban Bayis Sheni. Hillel and Shammai. Hillel was the chief rabbi. Shammai was the assistant chief rabbi. They mentioned in Pirkei Avos. The Gemara says they lived 100 years before the Churban Bayis Sheni. A different Rabbi Hillel. Hillel and Shammai, they were so great, we don't even call them Rabbi Hillel. Hillel. The Gemara says, if a person gets smichi, you call him Rabbi. If he's chief rabbi, you call him Rabban. And a greater title, Gadol Mirabban, a greater title than that is Shmo. Just say his name, Hillel, Shammai. That's a greater than giving him a title. So that was Hillel. This was a Rabbi Hillel who lived in the days of the Amoraim. And the Gemara says, God should forgive him. God should forgive Rabbi Hillel. He made a mistake. We don't accept that. Melech HaMashiach is going to be a human being, a bas of Adam, who will be a direct descendant, Benach HaBen from David HaMelech. That's why we call him the Mashiach. Mashiach means one who can be one who may be anointed with Shemen Mishkas Kodesh. Shemen HaMishcha to the Beis HaMikdash has Kedusha. So only allowed to use it to anoint Kohanim Gedolim, or a melech from the Malchus Beis David. Any other king, like Shaul HaMelech, any other king, when they split after Shlomo HaMelech died, and the country was split, it was Malchus Eretz Yehuda, Malchus Yehuda, Malchus Israel. So those who were Malchus Yehuda had the right to be anointed with Shemen Mishkas Kodesh. Those who are Malchus Yisrael, they're not allowed to use Shemen Mishas Kodesh. That's reserved only for the kings who are from Malchus Beis David. About 20 years ago, there was an article in the Jewish Times, in the New York Times, on the first page, that they found a jug of oil, parsimony oil, from the days of Yashke. So they explained to you what is the significance of the parsimony oil, that this is a special oil that they used to use to anoint the Davidic kings when the Malchus Beis David. So this is all the news that's fit to print, but it's incorrect. It's just a hate book. The Gemara says, Shemen Afarsimon, the parsimony oil, was what they used to anoint one who was not a king from the Malchus Beis David. Those who were kings from the Malchus Beis David, they would be anointed with Shemen Mishchas Kodesh, not with Shemen Afarsimon. So we assume that the Melech HaMashiach, there will be a period of Mashiachiyut, where there will be peace in the world, and there will be a human being who will be a direct descendant, Benach HaBen, from David HaMelech. The Rambam writes in one place, in the Pirush HaMishnayis, that the Melech HaMashiach will be, David HaMelech had a lot of wives. He had 18 wives, and each wife he had children. So the Rambam writes that our tradition has it, we're not sure what the source is. He claims our tradition has it. Melech HaMashiach will be a descendant of David HaMelech and Shlomo HaMelech, not from the other children of David. Only a Benach HaBen from Shlomo HaMelech and David HaMelech. There are other differences in halacha. There's difference that only those who are from the Malchus Beis David can have the Sheikh of Hashem and Mishkas Kodesh. That's a difference on the level of the Raisim. Because it's a din be'ila be'hegdush, if you use Shemen HaMishka for purposes other than what it's designated for, then you're in violation of be'ila. The Gemara has the other differences. Ein yeshiva ba'azara. No one is allowed to sit in the azara, even the kangaroo. The only one who's allowed to sit is the melech and the malchus based on it. Because the official king of Eretz Yisrael is really HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the melechim for the malchus based on it represent HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So they're allowed to sit. That's why it says that when David HaMelech died, Vayeshem Shlomo, Al-Kisi Hashem, he took over this, that was the official malchus. The malchus HaNevcheres, that was the official malchus. Rambam in the beginning of Hilchus Melachim writes another difference, that no king other than the Malchut Beis David have the right to use Yerushalayim as their capital. Yerushalayim is the official capital of Eretz Yisrael for the official government. The official government is the Malchut Beis David. So only the Melech and the Malchut Beis David is allowed to use Yerushalayim as the capital. That's why a lot of people say that the American Congress in so many years didn't want to recognize Yerushalayim as the capital. They didn't want the Israeli government to violate the din. Because the Israeli government now is not from the Malchus Beis David. So the Rambam seems to say that no government other than the Malchus Beis David is supposed to use Yerushalayim as the capital. Maybe we're preparing now. Maybe we're preparing for the Melech HaMashiach. That we officially declare Yerushalayim as the capital because Moshiach is on his way. The Rambam writes very interesting with respect to in the letter that he sent to Geras Teiman. He writes in the letter, we all have an obligation to hasten the coming of the Moshiach. How can you hasten the coming of Moshiach? We don't have control over the matter. What can we do to hasten the coming of Moshiach? So the Rambam says to pray to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Every day in the davening, we ask HaSemach David Abdecha Meiris HaTzmiach HaKadosh Baruch Hu should speedily send the Melech HaMashiach. Whenever we have an obligation to take care of something, and it's not in our control, so the only thing we can do is to pray to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We have such a similar din regarding Bikur Chaylim. The real mitzvah of Bikur Chaylim is not to visit the sick, but rather to heal the sick. Mora says that Rabbi Akiva had thousands of students, and one day the Mora says he noticed that one of the students was absent for a couple of days. So he asked the other students, where is so-and-so? He said, he's sick in the dormitory. So he went to the dormitory, Rabbi Akiva went to the dormitory, he opened the window, he swept the floor, he changed the sheet, he told him to change his pajamas, he gave him some medication, and he got better. Said, that's the mitzvah of Bikur Chaylim, to heal the patient. By us, the doctor's already prescribed the medication. The nurses are applying the medication. The fellows in the hospital are at home. Everything is taken care of. So the only thing that's left is that the patient should be put in a good mood. If the patient is in a positive mood, then he stands a chance of getting better faster. So that's why by us, the mitzvah is Bikur Chaylim, to visit the sick and to cheer them up. But in Shulchan Aruch, they quote from the Rabbi that if someone visits the sick and they don't offer a tefillah, that the sick patient should get better, then they're not yetzer the mitzvah, Bikur Chaylim. Because Bikur Chaylim is to do the maximum that is in your power to help the patient recover, that is, you get better. So you had an opportunity to offer a tefillah and you didn't. You didn't daven. You didn't daven, you didn't do the maximum in your power to heal the patient. So the same is by the hastening of becoming a Mashiach. Maximum we can do is to offer a tefillah. So every day the Rambam says we have to daven that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should hasten becoming a Mashiach. Rav Yehuda Alkalai, who is the rabbi here for so many years, is always referred to as the first Orthodox Zionist rabbi. Until the days of Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai, it was assumed that Moshiach will come, min HaShemayim, he'll fly in the air with Nisim and Nefilos. The Yod Navi will come, Moshiach will come, and we won't have to lift a finger. And during his lifetime, that notion changed. He and another two Rabbanim changed that notion. Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai came up with the Chiddush that the Gemara speaks about Moshiach ben Yosef preceding Moshiach ben David. So it's very unclear what this is all about. The Gemara only mentions it in one place, in the end of Gemara Sukkah. In the Zohar it appears many times. Abud al-Kalai and others insisted that this is what it means, that the Jews have to make a hakana. Yosef HaTzadik was the prime minister of Egypt. So first we're going to have to do political maneuvering and political activities in order to be zeichet to have Moshiach ben David come later on. So he interpreted the Gemara, Ein Yisrael Nigolim Ela B'tshuva. The simple meaning is the Jews will repent from their sins. So he said that's part of it, but tshuva means Lashuv L'Eretz Yisrael, to return to Eretz Yisrael. And if we're not going to return to Eretz Yisrael first, then Moshiach is not going to come. Ein Yisrael Nigolim Ela B'tshuva. So he started this movement over here. He didn't get too far. He didn't succeed too much at all. He started the movement over here. And then another two Rabbanim, who were really Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva Eger, also started it. One was Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Kalasher, whose commentary appears on the bottom of the page in the Big Yerideya and all the standard editions. And one was Rabbi Elia Gutmacher, Rabbi Elia Greiditzer. He was a rabbi in Greiditz, also a Talmid of Rabbi Akiva Eger. Rabbi Akiva Eger lived in Germany. So each one of them independently was tumbling about this, that the Jews should return to Eretz Yisrael, and this will hasten the coming of Mashiach. We have to do hachanas. At some later day, they all realized that all three of them are pushing for the same thing. So then they used to sign kol koreis together. But originally, each one didn't know about the other one. And then he claimed now that Herzl heard from Rav Al-Kalai in his drushes about Zionism, and that's what started him and his bug about the Zionism. Abu al-Kalai was a strictly Orthodox rabbi. He was extremely opposed to the Reform movement, because the Reform, in one of their conventions at Braunschweig, took out every mention of Eretz Yisrael and Beis HaMikdash and Korbanis from the davening. And they were anti-Zionists. They weren't interested in moving back. He said, that's scandalous. And he wanted all the Jews to speak Hebrew. We have to have something to unite us. So he thought we should all go back to speaking Lashna Kodesh. Really, speaking Lashna Kodesh is the Rambam writes in his commentary on Pirkei Avos, Avizar b'mitzvah kala kalach amura, that the mitzvah kala is the daber b'lashna kodesh. So Rav Al-Kalai encouraged everyone to speak Lashna Kodesh. He also originally he thought we should have a Nusach Achid of the Siddur, instead of the Ashkenazim and the Sfardim and the Teimanim and every group having their own Nusach HaTfilah, we should all have one Nusach. That's what years later Rabbi Gorin introduced in the army, the Nusach Achid, a blend of all together. And then Rav Al-Kalai backed out from that. He realized that that's not a smart idea. When Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalasher passed away, Rav Al-Kalai outlived him. So he insisted that they should be Mechaber Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalasher. So they named the kibbutz after him. Tira Tzvi was named after Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalasher. And Ste Eliyahu was the kibbutz that was named after Rav Elie Gutmacher. Rav Elie Gutmacher is known as a holy tzaddik. And he was, they tell the story that the Chafetz Chaim was not happy with all the chassidish stories about the tzaddikim, about the mofsim. So they said to him, what about Rav Elie Greiditzer, the Talmud of Rav Akiva Eger? That they say all the cholim, everyone would come to him and he would give brachas with mofsim and everything. So Rav Elie Greiditzer, that's an exception to the rule. That's a different story. Because when he was a young teenager learning by Rav Akiva Eger, they say that he once attended a wedding. And he was dancing like a wild man at the one of the Talmidim of Rav Akiva Eger got married. And he was dancing like a mishoganist. So the Balabatim asked Rabbi Kivega, what kind of crazy students do you have? So Kivega said, the Gemara has an expression, sometimes a Tamachachim gets all tzehitz, gets all fakacht about something, excited. So the Gemara has an expression, Araisahu de Rasachbe. The Torah is Eish Das. And this Rabbi Elie Gutmacher, he had so much learning in him when he was a teenager. He was a little wild. Because I rise to the Rasata. So that's what the Chafetz Chaim said. And Rabbi Kivega said about this man when he was a teenager, I rise to the Rasata. So his mopsim come from the Kayach HaTor. It doesn't come from the Siddur Shemaisa. But the tour guide mentioned before that Rabbi Yud Al-Kalai published quite a few Svarim In addition to all the Sfarim, he published many different essays that we should all move back there to Yisrael and go to Gemaris and Sukkim and passages from the Zohar. He was strong in Kabbalah also. He was familiar with all of the sources. The previous tour guide mentioned that they founded a school for agriculture in Chulon. The three Rabbanim, Rabbi Yud Al-Kalai with the Yishkalisha, they wanted to institute more schools for agriculture. They thought that the Jews have to go into agriculture in Eretz Yisrael. But the end of the story was they only made one and they didn't have one. He was one of the original founders of the Zionist movement, but he didn't really get too far. He wasn't really too successful. He was just successful in publishing all of the essays. He was born Al-Kalai, was born in Sarajevo, the age of 11. He moved there to Israel, he learned there. Then he came back to serve as the chazan, as the Shliach Tzibur here the Jews called the city Zemlet. The guy called it Zaman, and the Jews used to call it Zemlet. So he came back to serve as the Baal Tefila, and then later on he was appointed the rabbi here. But when the Mizrahi always writes about the different prominent rabbis who were leaders in the Zionist movement, so the first name is always Rabbi Yehuda Chai Al-Kalai. His father's name, I think, was Shlomo.